Station number 11944.
Transjaland Wheel 3. What did you feel when you heard you'd been posted to the Durhams rather than to the Kings?
King's Hill.
King's Hill.
Kings are from Liverpool. I was very pleased, I think. The reputation of the Durham Light Infantry was very high in the Middle East, and the reputation of the division was very high. And I felt pleased. I was, I'd been sorry originally not to go to the King's Own. I was glad in the end that I didn't get there, because I'd have been put in the bag. I was pleased to be going.
Did you have any prior connection with Durham?
None at all. I'd never been to Durham in my life. I didn't know any Durham people. Absolutely, a complete outsider.
Could you say a bit more about how you actually got there?
Yes, I went into Dakota with the two other chaps, including Gray. We flew, I suppose it would be from Cairo, I don't know, I think we had one stop at Benghazi and spent the night in Tripoli, one night in Tripoli, and then flew across to Sicily and landed in a field. It was a case of Dakotas with no seats, of course. We sat on the cargo on the floor. I remember they had small windows in them with a small detachable plug in the middle of the window, and our instructions were that if we were attacked by Messerschmitts, or other similar hostile fighter aircraft, we were to remove the plug in the middle of the window and put our revolvers through and shoot back at the oncoming fighter plane. But I do remember that about the trip.
Where was the field where you landed? Was it close to the area where the Durhams were deployed?
I think it was somewhere down near Port Augusta. Syracuse, that sort of area. It wasn't right up. It was a field big enough to take Dakotas. It wasn't a little forward fighter base. It was a purely temporary. I mean, it was across, bumping across the ground.
Did they have a mesh carpet laid for the planes to land on?
I think they did. I can't remember in detail now, but I suspect they must have done.
What happened to you then? How did you actually get up to the battalion?
Transport of some kind. I think it went up in a lorry. I know I arrived in the dark. I met the taken to battalion headquarters. I met the colonel, who I think was Colonel Lidwell at the time, and the adjutant, and in due course a runner or somebody took me out to 13th platoon. I didn't meet the company commander immediately. I remember the next morning waking up at dawn and found that having spent the night, or what was left of the night, in this slit trench. And I remember seeing a very imposing figure in a fur-lined flying jacket, boots, field boots, and a very smart peaked cap. And I thought, this must at least be the company commander. So I leapt to my feet and saluted. And the company sergeant major corrected me and said that he was not entitled to a salute from an officer, but there it was. But that was my introduction. And I also remember noticing later in the day, just near the nice slit trench, the some meat with some wasps, I think they were, who were carving it up and flying off with little pieces. And I gather that was part of my predecessor, the last officer who'd been occupied in that slit trench.
What had happened to him?
He'd been killed, I suppose. I don't know.
Do you know what had killed him?
I suppose a shell. But I don't know.
How were you received when you arrived then?
I wasn't really. I was just there, and I was the new officer, and I was accepted. And of course, I wasn't wearing the right outfit. I was dressed up for the base, and they'd had so many officers through the battalion. I suppose they were used to these people coming and going. They were all friendly, laughing. The men were extremely kind. I had a very good batman called Arthur Atkinson. I got him because the last batman had been killed, and this man, I wanted a batman. The Arthur Atkinson arrived, and he was a 2-inch mortar man, and I asked him why he wanted to be a batman, and he said because they'd lost 3 officers, such short notice, and he thought it was bad for morale for a platoon not to have an officer, and he thought that all those officers could have been saved if they'd known what they were doing. And he said that he could become my batman, then he would promise to look after me in the field. There we are. What have we got?
Well, you were telling me that your batman...
Is it going?
Yes.
Yes. Arthur Atkinson said that we'd lost these officers unnecessarily, and he said that he thought it would be a good idea if he was to look after me in the field, provided that I protected him from NCOs and other people when we got back to away from action. And he said he'd never been a batman before, he didn't know what was involved, but he was concerned to be my bodyguard, and that's what he became. He was absolutely first class, he was terribly brave. He and I were together, I suppose, as far as Belgium. I never went out on patrol without his going with me. I never had to ask him. He seemed to have a second sense, or seventh sense, sixth, of danger. And he was a man of very great courage, and he certainly knew his campaigning. And I think, with due respect to everybody, I think I probably learned more soldiering from him than I did from anybody else the whole of the war, because he really was first class as a fighting soldier, private soldier. The only difficulty with him, he was about 19, 20. He was a bit man. Till he joined the army, he'd never had his own bed in his life. He'd always slept on the floor. He'd never had any bedding. He'd always had old coats to cover him. He was as poor in civilian life. He was as poor as a church mouse. And what was worse, from my point of view, difficult, was that he had one of the strongest Geordie accents that I'd ever come across. And, of course, I'd never come across a Geordie accent before. And in addition to that, he had a very bad stammer. So the communications between the pair of us to begin with were anything but easy, but we became very close friends in the end.
You say that he had a great deal of what one might describe as tactical nous.
He had battle experience,
yes. How long had he actually been in the army when you met him first?
I don't know. I don't think he was at Dunkirk, but he'd certainly been in the desert. So he would be that sort of, he'd be a desert ex-8th Army, or 8th Army.
So he'd been through some...
Oh, yes. He knew what he was doing. Yeah.
What sort of things did he teach you? What were these basic survival skills that he thought the other officers might...
Well, for example, I remember this very well, because I was embarrassed by it. Very shortly after my arrival... Spando started up, and I adopted the prone position at high speed, and I was conscious of the fact that his boot and anklet were close to my head, and when I looked up, he was grinning down at me, saying, "It's quite all right, sir, it's not aiming at us, not shooting at us." And when subsequently another Spando went off, he put his arm across my shoulders and threw me down on my face and said, "They are aiming at us this time." And it was that sort of basic stuff which he was so good. He knew exactly what he was doing. Very fine. And no doubt useless on a parade ground. Useless, such I imagine, at spit and polish. But basically a good fighting man. The kind I wanted.
Was he, do you think, a nuisance in barracks?
Oh, no. Not in that sense. He wasn't a sort of backroom lawyer or a cocky person at all. He was very popular and a nice chap. He might have been a bit of trouble when he had too much ale, but nothing else. I mean, he wasn't a fighting man. He wasn't one of these aggressive people you do come across sometimes.
So he could tell whether you were being shot at or not. That was a central basis. Did you develop the same sort of ear?
Oh, yes, of course. Don't take no time at all to learn that one. Just as the, you never really have to learn how to adopt the prone position. I found that came quite naturally.
What other skills did he teach you that were good for survival prospects?
He seemed to know whether there'd be any Germans there. He seemed to know, you know, any particular village or outpost, whatever it was. He seemed to sense where they'd be if they were there. He seemed to know whether or not it was the Germans were determined or whether they were merely being a nuisance. And that sort of thing. And also he used to know how to get into a place. The Durhams, as you know, were always restless. They never stayed in lines. They were always patrolling all the time. And, of course, he was very good at it.
It sounds as though he had an instinctive feel for ground. Instinctive grasp of the essentials of field craft.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you think that's an inborn quality, or do you think it's something that can be learned?
Oh, I think it can be learned. I think it can be learned. Certainly, my experience later with the snipers, after that period, and the next period when we're back in UK, I certainly learned a tremendous amount of fieldcraft and so on in that way. But I think it can be learned.
Now, you were joining the battalion just after the fighting at Primosoli Bridge. They'd had a fairly...
They'd had a real packet, Bridge.
They must have taken a lot of casualties.
Well, they did.
What was their mood like when you joined them?
Very cock-a-hoop, waiting to go. The Primosoli was behind them. They were waiting for reinforcements and so on, and they wanted to get on with it. We wanted Catania. And that was the general attitude. Of course, all the companies were below strength, and 13 platoon was below strength. But it was very cock-a-hoop.
Did the replacements come up quickly to bring your platoon up to strength?
Don't know. Can't remember. They came in dribs and drabs. You'd get a couple of men one day and one man the next. And sometimes you got the NCOs arriving, new NCOs. And of course, there was a certain amount of crosswise movement between platoons and companies. Where they tried to make them up to strength and get them all even. So it wasn't a case of a flood of them or anything like that. And again, the Durhams, out looking back, I think were always careful to integrate. In other words, they put new people in with the old ones. And they didn't let the new ones obtain numerical superiority in any two. And so that anybody like myself was, as a completely green soldier, was put in with experienced men, experienced officers. And again, I learned in that way. And they were very, very welcoming, terribly friendly. I'd never realised that the army, as such, could be such a friendly organisation, particularly after my experience with the Border Regiment.
When you got your replacements, were they all Durham men, or did you have men coming from other parts?
No, I can't say now, but I suspect they were not Durham men. I should think by that time, with the number of battalions that Durham County and Durham City was providing all around the world, there wouldn't be sufficient people from Durham to man them. Uh-huh.
When you did get new men coming into the platoon, roughly how long did it take for them to settle down and get into the frame of mind where they could instinctively do what the platoon required them to do?
Well, I suppose rather like myself, they settled in surprisingly quickly. Everybody was so friendly. People were a bit nervous, were jollied along, and they were cheered up and encouraged. And I don't think at that stage there was a fear of going into action or anything like that, because I think the warm relationship of the people that were joining was the effect, well, you know, thank goodness you're here, it's marvellous to have you. Seemed to be the attitude right with the officers and the men. And the battalion, of course, was, I realised later, as a whole, tended to be very informal. But I suppose that was inevitable in action. There wasn't a great deal of class distinction between the officers and men, or the NCOs and men.
I was going to ask you about that, about the way in which discipline was carried on, whether it was in a formal or an informal way.
Well, again, you say, how was discipline carried on? I'm never conscious of it. I did come across it later on in Northwest Europe, where we had a lot of these battle school dugouts were being cleared out from their nice cushy jobs and were sent out to join us, never having seen an angry German in their lives. They were sent out to take over the companies, and they started putting people on charges for dirty boots and that sort of thing. I came across discipline there, which was very bad indeed, but that was because these senior majors and so on just didn't know what they were doing. It was great, as far as we were concerned. I'm not conscious of having to have any discipline. People did what they were told, and they never queried it. And in fact, as far as I was concerned, quite often, it was a group solution. In the sense, you'd say to the chaps, "Well, what shall we do now, chaps? Shall we, you know?" Oh yes, sir. Let's go and take that village. And there was a great deal of that going on. I was never conscious of anybody being forced to advance or being ordered to do this or that. I mean, the orders were carried out. We received orders from the commanding officer or the company commander. But it was a case of, "Will you go round there and just you occupy that area?" It was informal, and it worked. That's the thing, it worked. I think it worked very well indeed.
I was going to ask you about how you received your orders. Did the company commander and battalion commander issue formal orders, or did he...
Oh, no. Not that I know of.
He didn't?
No. You get a message saying, we're moving on later on, or, you know, we're staying here for the night, dig in, or whatever it was. There was nothing in writing.
And you mentioned that you were saying that you often took advice from the men in your platoon.
Well, no, I didn't say I took advice. We discussed it. And when I say we probably had a school solution. In that sense, I was quite prepared to be taught by... I was quite prepared to learn from old sweats the best way of dealing with Germans and Italians.
So you would make the decision that you would have the brains of the entire platoon at your disposal.
Yeah. That way you'd get them to do it, I thought.
Did the company commander and the colonel operate in the same way?
I don't know about the colonel. I suspect Colonel Lidwell wouldn't. But I had a company commander, Johnny Wheatley, and I'm sure he did. And perhaps I learnt the knack from him, I don't know. Yes, I think he was... I think he did it that way too. But it was a case of will you rather than do it. And of course it's that egging people on where you get results.
Did you ever get written orders?
No. No.
Had you done a lot of work on written orders while you were at Sandhurst training?
Oh, I had a little notebook with a brown thing with that thin paper with a, I forget what it's called now, the graph paper. I had one of those, oh yes, and I don't remember any ever using it for orders to anybody. You might send a message with it to somebody, but it was usually done by word of mouth. Send a runner with somebody, that sort of thing. And you get a message, go and pick your ammunition up at so-and-so, or so George has got the maps, or whatever it was. And that was the way it was done.
It's all done by informal word-of-mouth orders?
Yes, as far as I remember. I've known that higher up, but I was at the working end.
Presumably the orders then were very brief. You didn't have any...
Yes, the Sicily... again, looking back, Sicily tended... You tended to get the information as to what was happening far more. You knew that we were going to Messina. We had to get to Messina. It was we were going along the East Coast Road. There were seven bridges, and all those bridges would be blown by the time we got there. And the Etna was on the left. And that was the sort of we had the picture. We knew where we were told where other people were, the Americans, for example. We knew where they were, and we also knew that the overall picture. But how we got there was more or less off the cuff as we arrived at the situation. We dealt with it.
How did you get this information? Did you have a sort of information room maintained by an intelligence officer?
No.
Was it just
no,
by...
No, I never saw an information room in my life in Sicily. I don't think I ever saw an information room. How can you, really? I mean, I wouldn't expect it, because the battalion had no command vehicles. It wasn't like brigade where I finished up, where we had our command vehicles and map rooms and so on. But no, not as far as we were, as a platoon commander. I never saw a map room. I would perhaps be given a map, but that was all. I had a map case, which I never used. I used to fold the map out and put it in my hip pocket. That was the way everybody seemed to be going on, and it was good enough. And I remember I was subsequently in Normandy with one of these ex-battle school wallers. I remember his rebuking me at one of his old groups on the basis that I was putting all the positions in the same coloured China graph, and that I should have had red for the enemy and blue for us, or guns were black or something like that. And of course the answer was I'd only got on China graph and I was doing my best, but he was very annoyed that I wasn't carrying out the rules with regard to the colours of China graphs on a map. I did use a map case for him, but apart from that it was very informal.
So how did you get your information? Did it just come down informally with orders? And?
Well, the company commander used to come round and say, we're doing this, we're doing that. And we also got information from other people. Generally, we collected information from the people like the mortar officers or the mortar officer or the anti-tank officer, the chaps who wandered round the battalion positions generally, the intelligence officer, intelligence sergeant, it was Sergeant Bark. He used to come round all the time. But they were telling us what was happening, who was doing what, which company was where. We were going to follow through. It was that sort of... It was a very effective way of doing it. And we felt confident that we knew what was happening.
Now, you were saying that when you turned up, you were not dressed in the battalion style. What style of dress did you adopt?
I think I turned up in, as far as I remember, a sort of khaki drill service dress jacket and that sort of thing, and suitable for the base in Cairo or Geneva. And then, of course, I very soon learnt that people never wore tin hats, or they didn't seem to. And they were always in various sorts of headgear, peak caps and that sort of thing. They were allowed, some of the people had Indian pattern shirts, the grey flannel ones, Others had dark khaki. There was some people had green shirts. It was very informal altogether.
What did you wear then once you'd settled in?
I used to wear slacks. I didn't wear shorts. I used to wear slacks, a khaki shirt with long sleeves and two breast pockets, and webbing.
What headgear did you adopt?
A peak cap. And again, I had a King's Own cap, which I was very proud. It was had the distinction of being the only cap in the British Army, which was leather-bound round the peak. And it had a thin leather binding round the peak. It was a khaki cap. And the King's Own 2 always wore Guards Barathea. Their uniforms were not the ordinary khaki, they were dark Guards colour. And the cap was, of course, to match. So I had this with a this peak cap with the Durham badge on. Real mixture. I also wore a... Yes, I wore a lanyard as well. Green lanyard on my left shoulder.
Could you tell me something about the positions you were in when you arrived? Because I'm presuming you were still at the Premasovic Bridge.
We were on the other side of it. Yes, it was a sort of flat plain land. And whatever that man said who mentioned last night, it was flattish, it was vineyardy country. And it was, as far as my memory goes, certainly to the other side of Catania, it was flat and flattish to the sea. We couldn't see the sea from where we were too far inland. But it was low-lying land going in front of us.
And how far could you see, do you think? What was your sort of horizon from your slit trench?
Oh, I suppose 300 or 400 yards. There was a copse or a wood. And I remember the Germans were supposed to be in there.
That was looking northwards, was it?
Yes.
And how was the platoon actually laid out? What did the platoon position look like?
I don't know. I can't remember. There were little groups of people all over the area. They tended to be in, I think, section groups. And they'd have three or four small slit trenches, a couple of men in each. They seemed to prefer the double slit trench for company. And that was the way they operated. But I can't remember. I don't know front lines or anything like that now. I don't know which they were, where they were looking. I couldn't tell you really where anybody was at that time, because we moved on almost as soon as I got there.
So you don't remember whether or not it sort of conformed to any pattern?
Oh, textbook pattern? No, I don't think it did. But apart from that, I can't say why not, but I wasn't conscious of an organised... pattern as laid out in a battle school plan or a book. No, don't know.
You were saying that you were shot at by Spandaus shortly after your arrival. Were they firing from this wood?
Yes.
Yes.
I think, in fact, they were probably rear guard. They, as you know, must have known from your earlier interviews, it had been the Hermann Göring division, the parachutists, which had been the opposition there, and they'd pulled out. They'd been flown in for this particular battle and then gone. And I think they'd probably left pickets out, a few men at a time, as they did a lot, the Germans. Probably had one man with a spando, two men with a spando, just to keep us quiet.
Keep amused and preoccupied.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long did you stay there then? Were you just there overnight? And then?
Oh no, we were there for a day or two.
You were there for a day or two?
A day or two.
And the enemy were disengaging and...
Well, I don't know. Nothing was happening.
Did the battalion send any patrols forward to find out if they were...
Yes. Oh yes, there were patrols. Yes, there and other places too. The Durhams, the 8th Durhams, were never still. They'd take a town or a village... And before anybody dug in they had patrols out in front, seeing where they'd gone and if they were there, or it saved digging in unnecessary if we're going to move forward again. I doubt very much whether any other units in the British Army patrolled more than the Durhams. And it was the two men, three men sort of patrol, which was, of course, so effective.
Reconnaissance patrol.
Yes, not fighting patrols.
So what happened then when you were finished at Primus Oly Bridge? Did you?
Well, in due course, we moved onwards. I'll take Catania. And we moved up there.
Did you move up on foot or in transport?
Oh, no, on foot. And we went there and we went along the edge of that wood. And it was there that I saw my first dead Durham. And I remember being surprised that he was absolutely black. Body decomposing. But I remember him with his Durham flashes and so on. We walked past him and he just lay there on his back and where he'd fallen. That was the first time I saw a dead man in...